This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. A quick note at the top, after several attempts to get Liberal leader Ian Rankin on the line for an interview, he was unable to connect with us before our deadline. In the idea of fairness, we had the leaders of the NDP and the Progressive Conservatives on two previous episodes, and we were hoping Mr. Rankin would be able to do the same. The provincial election is on August 17th. Meanwhile, this week, an Olympian and gold medalist from Cape Breton is on the show to talk about how he became interested in the sport and what it takes to be among the best in the world. Also, a comedian from Escazone will hear how he gets his material, and he'll talk about an unusual performance in a place where laughter is usually the last thing on someone's mind. These stories are coming up on the Coast. There's a young comedian from Cape Breton turning it up a notch these days, getting noticed and setting his sights on some of the biggest festivals where you'll find some of the biggest names in the business. Clifton Cremo says it's no joke that making people laugh is one of his most favorite things to do in the world. Here he is now starting out talking a bit about his roots and how he became interested in comedy.
My name's Clifton Cremo. I'm 28 years old. I was born in Sydney. But I was raised in Escazone First Nation. I grew up on my mother's side of the family. My grandfather was Lee Cremo, very popular fiddler. I didn't inherit any musical talent, but he had a sense of humor, so I inherited that. And my whole side of my family, the whole Cremo side of my family, are very funny. So I've always had a sense of humor. I enjoyed stand-up growing up, and I got into stand-up kind of by accident. I went to an open mic night to meet up with a friend, and I kind of dared myself to get on stage, and my friends that were there with me that night supported me, so I kind of lucked into it, and I did well enough to want to continue to pursue it.
So you mentioned your grandfather, a very well-known fiddler from Escazone, Lee Cremo, and you said you don't play the fiddle, but you inherited his sense of humor. Regardless of that craft, singing, stand-up, public speaking, sharing your gift with people and getting on stage, they all have something in common. And I guess you got your grandfather's DNA enabling you to do the same, to entertain people.
It is a lot of performance. I mean, regardless, he spoke with an instrument. I speak with my voice, I guess. And it's just being comfortable. And I think a big part of him was he was so friendly and approachable. And I've never heard a bad story told about him. And I mean, that could be because he's passed away, but I've never heard a bad story about him. Everyone always has something nice to say. So coming off as friendly and personable and approachable is kind of my outlook to being on stage. I try to be who I am off stage as well. So it's almost like a friendly conversation rather than a stand-up performances. It almost feels two-way, even though it's not.
That's pretty interesting what you said a moment ago about daring yourself to get up on the stage. And the way you explain that, it takes a lot of guts to do something like that, being unprepared. And what was your strategy there and with such little time to format and connect with people? How did you handle that?
I try to be myself on stage. So there's that. It can be kind of vulnerable, but typically I'm talking less about actual serious topics, and it's more jokes. So it's not. I never feel truly vulnerable up there, I suppose. And like I said, I was with friends, and all my friends and my family have been so supportive the whole time that, you know, even if I failed, they wouldn't hold it against me.
When did you first learn that you were funny?
Oh, geez, that's a loaded question. I mean, I'd like to think that I've always been funny, but like people have told me that, you've got that Crimo sense of humor. You're just funny. You're naturally funny. You should try stand up. That's one of those weird things that people tell you, is that you should try stand up, and they tell it to a lot of people, and a lot of the time they're wrong. A lot of the time they're right. Who knows? People do say encouraging things like that I was a funny person.
Does a comedian see the world differently than most people? When you're out and about your day, are you looking for experiences or a phrase that you can somehow translate into a joke? A common thing that people can relate to, but with a jolt of humor in it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. You see situations and you try to add some flavor. You try to add a joke, make things humorous. It does come naturally sometimes. Other times it doesn't. It can happen in almost any situation, even like, you know, stuff that you probably shouldn't be joking about. I almost kind of have to turn off my jokey thoughts in the moment.
When it comes to the comedian community and other performers that you run into here and there, are you protective with your jokes? Because a comedian would have to keep their material original, or is it more a sharing situation? How do you feel about that? Is it more exclusive for you in how you approach your jokes and your routine?
Not necessarily. No, I mean, if I have an idea or a basic premise, I have a few friends in the comedy world who I'll workshop jokes with. We'll chat, and you know, I'll pitch a punchline or something, and they'll tell me whether or not they think it's funny, and we kind of go from there, bounce ideas off of each other. As far as like stealing a joke, I don't know that it's necessarily stealing unless someone saw you perform it. There are some very basic premises out there in the world. Like, if someone else had a joke about lobsters, I guess, then I couldn't very well say that they stole it from me, because lobsters are a pretty common thing.
So when you're on stage with no set script, do you feel like you have to be quick on your feet? Is there a way to develop that skill?
Sometimes I'm quick on my feet. You know, someone will say something and then I'll have a quip and people will be like, oh, you're so quick, you're so funny, you're so fast. And then there's other times where, you know, I can't come up with anything to save my life, even if, you know, not even that funny or whatever. I can't come up with a response. So it just varies. You know, sometimes you got it, sometimes you don't. Some people have it more often than others. I have a lot of friends who are so quick. Just to name drop one of them, for instance, Matt Baker, he's a comedian in Halifax. One of the funniest guys, sharpest guys I've ever met. He always has a great joke. And because of that, when he performs, he does a lot of crowd work, because he can come up with stuff on the spot, and it's always so great and personal at every show. I'm not fast enough for that. I'm scared. I'm terrified of crowd work.
Oh, so comedian, that's what they call crowd work. When you hear a comedian ask someone in the audience, hey, where are you from? And you try to welcome them in and engage them in a conversation.
Yeah, basically. You get crowd work that way. Sometimes you get a heckler and then you have to deal with the heckler, whether it's, you know, shutting them up or playing along with their joke kind of thing. Basically any interaction with the crowd where it becomes a two-way conversation is crowd work.
How do you choose someone in the audience to be part of the act? Are people in the front row more likely to have fun with the comedian, or do you look for certain characteristics regardless of where they may be sitting in the audience?
You see it often at shows that are like general admission, where a lot of people will avoid the front seats because they think they're just going to get roasted or picked on. That's not necessarily the case. I mean, it can be. When someone's in the front row, it's just they're easier to access. You can hear their responses. It just makes them more accessible, really. Personally, whenever I do crowd work, which isn't often at all, don't get me wrong, but whenever I do crowd work, I just pick on whoever's kind of most directly in my line of sight.
And the hecklers, what's the best way to deal with someone who's getting involved like that and maybe giving you a hard time? Is it difficult to get back on track when you're dealing with someone who might be a bit unruly?
It can be like that. It definitely can be, where you're interfering with the comic's work. But I'd say more often than not, it's just going to be you're interfering with the show as a whole. If a heckler starts to talk to a comic and they start to have a dialogue back and forth, then the show becomes only for that person and everyone else is just kind of there. And it just ruins the experience for other people.
So you've performed at many different kinds of events. Can you talk about what it's like doing your routine, for example, for an adult crowd where adult drinks are being served? Do you prefer that kind of an audience over a place where you're working where there is no alcohol involved in? Is it a world of difference for a comedian when they're trying to do their work in either of those situations?
For some people, I would say it probably is. I mean, a lot of comedy clubs have a drink minimum. If you're an audience member, you know, 2 drink minimum or whatever. The logic there, I guess, is to, you know, support the bar, but also to, like, get people nice and pliable for laughter, I suppose. But I've done shows that are dry and I've done shows that serve alcohol. I haven't noticed too much of a difference. I did a show this past weekend at a campground that was BYOB because it was at a campground. It was one of the best crowds ever. I mean, they were all lively. But also I did a show at a funeral a couple years back, and you know, obviously no one's, I hope not, drinking at the funeral. And they were a great audience as well, especially considering the circumstances that a family member had passed away.
So you were hired to tell jokes at a funeral. That's one way to mark the occasion. Does that happen often? That seems like it might be unusual.
Yeah, very unusual.
That says a lot about the person who passed away. They must have had a pretty good sense of humor.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I did not know them personally, but their family members, the people who hired me for the funeral, they said that she loved to laugh, she loved comedy, and that that's what she wanted. She didn't want a sad funeral, quote unquote. She wanted people to have fun.
What was your reaction like when you first got the notice or the invite for doing a comedy routine at a funeral? Did you prepare differently, or?
I mean, I'm always decently confident. I've only ever bombed like maybe 1 or 2 times. I've been very fortunate in that regard, I guess. But I was very confident going in. The only preparation was that, because it was a funeral it was like a funeral luncheon kind of deal, and it was taking place at a church, I did not want to swear, so I had to stick to family-friendly material, especially because there, you know, were children at the place, so I had to really, really be on my game in terms of watching my language.
You know, Clifton, it'd be good to hear your opinion on this, on what actually makes something humorous, whether it's at a dry event or a funeral. And there was this explanation on the mechanics involved in what actually makes something funny, causing a person to physically react in laughter. And it seems like a simple explanation, but they say if you take something that is a normal thing in life and you add a splash of something that is absurd, something in our brain causes us to laugh when you mix those two things. An example being, if you remember those glasses, people would wear them on Halloween with the glasses with the big nose and the eyelashes. It's a normal situation, but exaggerated or made absurd. Is that something you might agree with?
I think typically in joke writing, you want to have like there's the basic setup and a punchline premise kind of deal. But it's taking something that the listener or the viewer can draw their own conclusion into, make it, take the expected and make it unexpected, I guess is the way to phrase that.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah, it's strange that laughing can be contagious. You hear someone laughing, and for some reason, it's funny. Even if you don't get the joke, it's kind of a mystery, isn't it?
Yeah. Even something as basic as like tickling, it elicits a laughter response, and it's because I guess it's almost like a physical attack, but you know that you're not going to be harmed. So it's the juxtaposition of that brings out the laugh.
Yeah, that's really strange, too. Getting tickled, it's torture, but somewhere in there, it's fun, or at least funny, and it's kind of strange. I wanted to ask you that, Clifton. When you're on stage, you see a lot of people laughing. What do you do about that one person who is making it clear they're not having a good time? And can you blank them out and just concentrate on the people who are having fun?
I think so. I mean, it's rare that you'd see someone stand out as not having fun. I think generally the room will be having fun. I mean, I've told some jokes that have gotten mixed responses where, like, you know, part of the audience groans, but part of the audience laughs or whatever. But as long as it's getting a response, I suppose. I mean, I wouldn't want to be booed off stage, but, like, as long as the majority of the room is laughing, it's successful, and I don't really focus on that. What I feel I'm pretty good at gauging a room and knowing what types of jokes that they're responding to, so I can adapt my set on the fly if I need to.
How would you describe your personality? Are you someone who your friends would say you're the life of the party? Or a lot of comedians, they say they're really shy, but they just flick the switch when it's time to go to work.
Oh, I'm definitely more reserved. I don't know if shy is the right word, but I'm very quiet. I'm a listener, I guess. I typically tend to only speak when I feel that I have a valuable opinion on a subject kind of thing. I did a performance for my workplace. I work at the school in Escazoni for the staff of our workplace, and half of them didn't know that I could speak.
And when you did speak, people must have been surprised that you would have this drive and that you have the natural ability to make people laugh.
That's what a lot of people were saying to me after, like, I didn't even know you were talking, you're so funny. And there's the not so great stereotype that comedians are depressed, and I think a lot of actors are too, and I think that comes from a lot of comedians actually are depressed, but their demeanors as well off stage, where they're not always on, and that's another thing too, like when you have to be on and you have to be funny, it can take something out of you, and you have to recoup, you have to recharge.
Do you ever feel like you're being put on the spot? Someone will come up and say, hey, say something funny, or just be funny. Do you ever get that kind of pressure?
Not in a serious way. I mean, a lot of people joke like, oh, you're a comedian, say something funny or tell me a joke. But they're kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek. They're just kind of poking fun at me or whatever. I don't think anyone ever seriously expects me to be funny on the spot.
Is it like a drummer or a guitarist where you can do this impromptu riff or a drum roll or something like that? It's not like having a catalog that you can fall back on and be spontaneous.
Yeah, yeah. That's happened to me like one time. I was at a house concert. They were playing music there, and then they were like, "Oh, Clifton does comedy, you know. Why don't you get up and tell some jokes?" And I was like, "I'd rather not. Like, comedy works best when people are there to see comedy. When people aren't there to see comedy, they're just not as receptive an audience."
So what about your role models in comedy? Who do you like to watch? Who are some of your favorites?
On the big scale, I'd say Norm Macdonald is one of my favorite comics. I love watching videos of his on YouTube where he's a guest on late night television. They're very easy to find. They're always very hilarious. I really like Mitch Hedberg, Eddie Murphy, Dave Chappelle. Just kind of like the usual suspects, I guess, these days. But locally, I've seen so many people that I truly enjoy, and I really like watching their joke writing process and having gotten to know them. You know, they're just great people, great comics. I really do love going to comedy shows locally that I'm not performing on, just to relax and laugh, you know.
Okay, and Clifton, where can people find out more about you? Where can they learn of any upcoming shows or see any of your bits?
If you're looking to find out more about me or my upcoming shows, you can add me on Facebook or follow me on Facebook, just my name, Clifton Crimo, or on Instagram, again, just my name, Clifton Crimo, or Twitter. I'm not very active on Twitter, but I do post dates and stuff like that whenever I can.
Yes, and for anyone who goes to visit any of Clifton's social media sites, you see some really funny material there, and he knows what he's doing, that's for sure. And again, you can find him on Facebook and Instagram under Clifton Crimo. And in just a second, we're actually going to play a short clip from one of your shows, and hopefully people will enjoy it. It's really funny. And thanks very much, Clifton, for taking the call and sharing your knowledge about your profession. And all the best. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. It was great to talk to you, too.
Do you guys remember the lobster stuff that was going on down in Digby? The lobster dispute? All the racism going on down in Digby? We had to deal with that. That was so frustrating because, you know, it was all anyone could talk about for a bit was lobster this, lobster that, lobster, lobster, lobster. It got super frustrating because, to me, there was just such an easy solution to the whole thing. Like, you line up all the white fishermen on one side, you line up all the native fishermen on the other side. You put the lobster in the middle, let the lobster choose. Work for my parents in divorce.
Next up, a tribute to Team Canada's performance at the Summer Olympics in Tokyo, especially to the women's rowing team who recently won a gold medal. Back in 1992, a Cape Bretoner was on the men's rowing team that won a gold medal in Barcelona. And here is the end of the winning race with Manitou's Michael Forgeron among the eight that crossed the finish line, narrowly beating Romania.
A great race for the Canadian men's eight so far, but this race is not over yet. We knew it would be close going in. It has been close, very close through the first 1,000 meters. We've less than half a race to go. The Canadian men's eights trying to make it 5 medals for Canada in this Olympic regatta. We already have gold. We already have bronze from Silken here. We're looking for another medal. Can we do it? The Canadian men's eights at the 12:50 mark, still leading Romania. Canada, Romania, and Germany. Those three have seemed to spread it out a little bit and have opened up a lead on the rest of the field. It is the Canadian men's eights right now. We are approaching the 500-meter mark, or 1,500-meter mark. 500 to go. Canada in front. Romania in second spot. Germany trying to hang on in third. But the Canadian eights are looking very strong now. Almost a half a boat length lead on Romania.
They couldn't be in a better position, I don't think, in a race plan. Do you, Silken?
This is fantastic. To be ahead 500 meters to go, they're going to be really going for it. They've got a strong last 500. Here they go.
What happens to your body at this point, Silken?
Your muscles are screaming. You know there's only 60 strokes left in the race, and you're just putting that oar in as fast as you can with as much power as possible.
Canadian eights, Roger, go ahead.
I was going to say, they've got the gold medal in their minds, I'm sure, with
this
all the success.
Great.
The women's eight won the gold, and they want to do the same thing. They're half a boat length out.
We are at the 250-meter mark. Way to go, Silken. The 250-meter mark to go. Canada, the Canadian eights are still in front. Romania
44.
And Germany very close for second. The Germans, I think, are moving up a little bit,
yes,
Silken.
Yes, they are moving up a little bit. They're dangerous right now, but I think the Canada has still a little bit in them. They've just got to lift that rate a little bit more.
The Canadian men's eights looking to make it four gold medals for Canada in the Olympic rowing regatta. They're looking strong, Roger. Their stroke rate.
20
they're
strokes to go.
They're around 39, 40 strokes with 20 strokes to go.
The last 50 meters, the Canadian eights. Romania now with a final push. Romania coming strong. Go, Canada. Can they hang on? They are there. They have just a few meters. Yeah!
Holy, I actually got goosebumps listening to that there, Mike. That was a few years ago, but what can you tell us about that outstanding moment in your life?
My goodness, just hanging on for dear life, Bill. Just, you know, just trying to make my body do, you know, one more stroke, one more stroke, one more stroke. And man, we were just, we were gunning, but the, we had timed everything to finish exactly at 2,000 meters. And we had done a big kick just with about 500 meters to go. So our tank was, we were a little bit running on fumes at that point.
So Romania was just on your heels there, as we heard a moment ago, and that was actually the closest rowing final in Olympic history. Your team was ahead by 0.14 seconds, and in the blink of an eye, really, that's some pretty intense competition. 0.14 seconds, it really doesn't get a whole lot closer than that, does it?
Oh yeah, no, it was fabulous. Romania had actually beaten us by 2 seconds in the semifinal. We had raced them in the semifinal, and Germany had, goodness, I don't know if they had. I don't think they had lost a race since 1988. We may have beaten them once in a match, not as critical a location, you know, not at the Olympics or the World Championships, but they had been, you know, essentially undefeated since 1988, and like I say, Romania had beaten us by 2 seconds just 2 days before. So the competition was really, really quite something. The conditions were fabulous, you know. A little bit, you can almost, you can almost hear on the replay that you had going through, because the sound, everything was carrying so well, and there was so much excitement, because you could really see the activity in the boats, right? Because the lake was so flat. It was on Lake Bagnoles, and it was just, the lake was only about 100 meters long, so as soon as the race was over, we were essentially, you know, kind of in the weeds. But yeah, the competition was fabulous. It was a great race. We basically went as hard as we could from stroke number one.
Is that something that you might call emotional whiplash, where you're using every fiber and focus and ounce of energy required in a gold medal performance to shortly a different kind of emotion not long after that, realizing you're taking home a gold medal for your country? And that's certainly, that'd be difficult for a lot of people to imagine what that feels like.
Yeah, so it takes a little minute. So the race is like the clip that you played was really cool to hear. It's certainly more than familiar to me. And the and people, if they want to see the end of the race, it's you can find it on YouTube. And then the last little bit, once we cross the line, it's a bit of a strange emotional turnaround, right? Because the first sort of kind of 2 minutes after you're finished, right, you're really, your body is just, you know, there's really not much left. So I this is not the most attractive thing, I guess, but I mean, I'm literally at the end of the race, you know, after we finished, I'm basically just drooling in the weeds. And then after that, you pick up, right? And we had to wait a minute because it was a photo finish. So for us, everything was like super quiet after we had sort of come back to life a little bit, and then everything was super quiet. And then after like a minute or a minute and 30 seconds, or I mean, it felt like a minute, it was probably like 15 seconds or something, you could hear the motors on the scoreboard turning, and then the photo finish comes up, and it had us first. So, and we had thought we were first, but we weren't 100% sure, you know, until you see it on the scoreboard. And then there's a tremendous sense of satisfaction because you're wearing the maple leaf and you're thinking of all the people that are watching you and that have supported you and that you're sort of carrying them with you as you race, you know, because they, you know what they've got invested in watching, and that sort of takes hold after that, and it's a tremendous feeling.
And then soon after that, you and your teammates, you're off to center stage as the winning team, as the world listens to O Canada to mark that victory. And how did you take in that moment? That must have been another very special moment for you.
No, it's those are sort of the emotional parts of the event once they're done, because it's you've finished and you've done what you've accomplished, right? And you know you're representing all the people sort of from coast to coast in Canada, and all the different groups we have and all the different cultures and everything that sort of builds us as a people to who we are. You know, when you're sort of an athlete, so that's sort of, you know, you internalize that stuff and you want to make sure that you represent everybody to the best of your ability. And sort of the really proud part of that is when the flag goes up and the anthem plays, right? Because that's sort of the recognition, right, that, you know, you've done that. And it's really a little bit hard to communicate in words, other than I've been in races before. The year before I was at the Pan Ams American Games in Havana, Cuba, and we were second, and you have to stand there and listen to somebody else's anthem being played. So it's and that part really sucks. So it's sort of sometimes the contrast is quite something there. Sometimes you don't really know how fabulous it is to stand there and have it played unless you've had the privilege of not hearing it played before.
What do you remember about your family's reaction to the performance there with Team Canada? And how did you and your teammates enjoy the rest of the day? It's certainly a good reason to celebrate there.
My family was watching on TV from home, you know, and listening on the radio. So they had a great day from here. I got to spend 3.5 hours in doping control as soon as we finished the race. So that's but everybody else went out and had a very nice party, though. I joined them as soon as I had finished running a doping protocol, just to make sure that everything was good and clean, and it was just purely random. And it was just so hot, and we'd been doing so much exercise that it took, you know, it was sort of, it was kind of like 3.5 hours before I could, you know, get them a sample that they could process.
And you weren't expecting that? That was just a random moment?
Well, you know, somebody's going to get picked for testing, right? And it's not a surprise, but it just happened to be me. So that's cool. It's just a very formal process, right? So we finish our race. We've won. We've got the gold medal around your neck, right? So and then somebody literally comes up, meets you at the boat, and then they follow you around as you do all the stuff, and then they take you to the doping control tent, and that person stays with you until until everything is good to go.
That seems like it could be off-putting, but nothing to worry about there, I'm sure. Mike, a lot of hard work and training to put your team across the finish line, nothing to do with performance-enhancing substances.
No, we did tons of work, right? So, and we were very, we built up trying to do enough work that, that nobody anywhere else could have, We tried to make it so nobody anywhere else could do more, right? And when you're training and when you get to race day, there's a strong comfort in that, right? When you know you're the best trained people on the planet.
So what about the events before the final? What was it like for you, and how do you get yourself in the zone after waking up that day, a day like no other, I'm sure, in your life? Do you listen to music, or do you need to have some alone time? Do you train? How do you make yourself ready for an Olympic event?
It's a little tiny bit different for everybody, I guess, Bill. So I kind of do mostly, what you would call alone, right? Other than that, you still have to be sort of a functioning human being, right? So you kind of have to still do the stuff you normally do. And you want to kind of run through a routine, because as much as it's a very it's a very special day, right? You also kind of want it to be a day that reflects all the training you've done. So in that respect, you're trying to make it sort of an ordinary day, right? So then, so all the things you typically do in your routine when you're training, you want to make sure you do those on race day. So your body kind of becomes tuned to those things, and it's like it's sort of running through the gears at that point. And then when you get to the race itself, again, there's like a tremendous amount of pressure when you're on the starting line of an Olympic Games, because it's only one race, and it's everything you've done for either 4 or 8 years, right? So you have to have stuff that you can focus on that lets you you want to let the energy run a little bit, because you want to be able to capture it and channel it into the race, right? But you also have to have enough control that's not debilitating. I'm a bit offside with this, but you're really, as much as it's a special day, you want to kind of make it an ordinary day.
How do you compare rowing to other sports, along with the endurance and the coordination that's involved? What kind of mind game do you have to bring to an event like that?
There's a lot of pressure in any racing like that. Rowing is a bit of a strange sport, because it generates a lot of lactic acid, right? So you know by the time you're about a minute in, you're going to be really uncomfortable, right? So you have to, from a mental perspective, you have to kind of embrace that, right? So you want to be, embracing the kind of the feeling of lactic acid coming on and there being a real sort of pain and strong burn in your muscles, because it means that they're working, right? And then if you're really well trained, that your muscles can process that. So it's kind of the pain that you're feeling and the discomfort actually kind of becomes a way to judge how fast you're going. So you kind of get into a mental state where you're almost approaching it sort of where you're sort of almost embracing that feeling as opposed to avoiding it. Now that said, it's also a very physical sport, right? It's like the mechanics are important, but really it's the training and the engines that carry. So there's there's just months and months and years and years and years of training that goes into that preparation to try and, you know, make your cardiovascular system and your muscles as powerful and as they can be, and as capable of carrying oxygen and removing lactic acid as they can be as well.
So when the eight rowers are in sync, and those boats are, they're over 60 feet long, but a rowing team takes complete command of a vessel. It looks like it's big anyway. Can you give a sense into the speed? How fast is your team actually moving on the water?
So it's a 2-kilometer race, and it took us 5 minutes and 29 seconds to do it.
So that's a pretty good skip across the water then, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an experience, right? And you've got either eight men or eight women putting everything they have into a very, very long light boat, you know, that just and when everybody's hitting it, it literally almost feels like it's jumping out of the water, right? And it's and particularly when everybody's doing everything in unison, because then all the force and all the power and all the leverage is being exerted at once, and the boat just feels like it's lifting and sort of firing forward. So I mean that feeling is, you know, that's it's not a feeling of flight because you're on the water, but it's something else.
Is there any communicating with your teammates in a rowing event? Do you talk to each other, or is the game plan mainly set before the race begins? Are you mostly silent during a race?
So in our boat, it was we were racing in eight. And we had a coxswain in the stern. So he's, in our case, we're racing, it could be either he or she. But in our case, he does the steering, and he's sort of watching all the other boats to see if we have to respond to something. And he's also really got the race plan sort of really set in his mind, and he's been over it and over it and over it. So he's really executing the race plan as we go, and trying to get us to do everything in unison. Because if we don't do everything in time, then the effort gets spent and sort of dissipated. Almost like if you were trying to have sort of five people lift a table. You know, if everybody does their own thing, the table never gets lifted, and everybody wastes a lot of energy. But if everybody lifts at once, the table comes off the ground. So the coxswain really is in charge of that. And when we're going, you know, at the pace that we're going, you're really going too fast to speak.
So then you come back to Cape Breton, and there's a welcoming party at the airport in Sydney. What do you remember about that? That must have been a memorable experience for you as well.
Oh, fabulous, right? So it's like I was saying before, you know, everybody I kind of felt like I was carrying everybody, you know, everybody from the island when I was there, right? Because they, you know, they were sort of, they were at the Olympics in Spain, and I was representing them. So when I got home, it was great. We had a fabulous, drive from the airport where we got to go through different areas, and everybody had signs out, and it's really something to know that you've had an impact on people, right? And that they've been watching you, and they felt that, you know, you've represented them well. So that's, you know, that's pretty moving.
And a few weeks after that, you came to Riverview High School in Coxeth, and there was a rally there in the gymnasium. I remember being a student actually there. Mike, you were wearing the gold medal, and I think you were wearing an Olympic track suit.
Yeah, I was wearing the jacket.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And did you see any of your old teachers there? Did you get to catch up with anyone?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely, right? And you see all the people, like, you see people that have had an impact on you, you know, over the course of your life as you sort of move towards becoming a fully developed human, right? So it was very neat, right? And a lot of different people have, you know, a lot of different impact in a lot of different ways, right? So, you know, for me to learn something about sport or to something that I carried with me on race day that helped me focus or, you know, that helped me move through training, that doesn't have to come through, you know, a lesson that you've learned in in another sport, right? It could have, but it doesn't have to be within the same sport. You know, I learned, I had lots of lessons that were taught in other sports, and then lots of lessons that were sort of taught by different teachers and different people in the community, and you know, and even different people that I grew up with, right? Because I had the benefit of, you know, being from Cape Breton. You have the benefit of sort of learning sports as you're growing up with lots of fabulous athletes, right? So that really helps, you know, develop me as an athlete as I progressed later in my career, a little bit later in sort of as I raced internationally in my 20s and into my early 30s.
And the people that had an influence, there's a story about how you became interested in rowing out of necessity at first, it seems. It was your father off the shores of Manadou when you were young. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I grew up in Manadou, right? And then, like I say, I went to Riverview for high school, Malcolm Memorial, Malcolm for junior high. And then I grew up fishing fishing for lobsters and fishing for cod and stuff like that. And when I was younger, we used to, so two things. One, you know, we used to row out to the boat in the morning because the boat at the time was moored in the harbor. It wasn't at the wharf sort of like they are now because there weren't quite as many boats. So every morning before we'd go fishing, we'd row out to the boat. So I kind of liked rowing, and as we grew up in Manadou, the guys that I, you know, the guys and girls that I would hang out with, we'd row the boats across the harbor, you know, during the summer, and we'd have small races like that. So that sort of, you know, sort of got the idea going. And then the work itself was, you know, very, like it was just very influential in my mindset in terms of performing, right? Perform and how to perform, and how to approach events and tasks. You know, when you're fishing lobsters or fishing for anything for that matter. You know, you're up early in the morning, you're out in a boat, you're in an environment that you have to sometimes adapt to. You know, you have to make sure that the weather isn't, you know, impacting, you know, how you do your job and how you move forward, and you stay and you do the job until it's finished, and you have to make sure you do everything you can in the one day, because you don't get to do that over the next day. As much as you're doing things that are the same the next day, you can't recapture what you lost the day before. So, you know, all those things kind of become core principles that you carry forward, and you learn to, you know, translate into the approach to, you know, in my case, high performance sport. So.
And Mike, of course, there's another gold medal winning Olympian on the other side of Cape Breton Island in gold medal in men's hockey for Team Canada a few years back. Have you ever had a chance to talk to Al McGuinness?
I think we crossed at either the Nova Scotia Sports Hall of Fame or the Cape Breton Hall of Fame. One of the induction ceremonies, I believe, and even though we've never, like other than that, we haven't met personally, but I've certainly watched him, right? And and watching that gold medal game, you know, I like watching sports, and I like watching, you know, people from Canada represent. And again, that was, you know, watching them play that game was fabulous.
So you're back on your old stomping ground in Manadou for a visit. What's it like coming back here after the delays and the restrictions that came with COVID?
Yeah, right now pretty good. Like there's a little bit of logistics involved. You know, you have to make sure that, you know, you're meeting all the protocol to come back, that you've, you know, been double vaccinated, and there's, you know, and that you can document that there's a certain amount of time that's passed since your second vaccination. So as long as you do all that and document that and get that to the provinces actually, because we drove through, that you can pass pretty easily through Ontario to Quebec to New Brunswick to Nova Scotia. And then this time is really nice because it's the first time in a couple of years that I've been able to come home and not have to quarantine, right? So, you know, and then when you're quarantining before, it's, you know, it's, you can hang around the house and walk outside the property and, be outside on the step, and if somebody is on the road, you can have a conversation with them. But now it's much nicer to be able to go and meet people in the community and wander around a little bit and sort of see the island and engage people that in the way you'd like to. So it's been a fabulous trip so far. I've been home for a couple of weeks and gotten to see all kinds of people that I haven't gotten to talk to in a while and go places where I couldn't go because I was a bit restricted before in terms of movement where I had to quarantine.
Before you go, Mike, for any athletes who are out there who might appreciate some advice from an Olympian, what would you like to say to them about stepping up their game or taking it to the next level?
Yeah, it's challenging, right? And if you're trying to reach the next level, you're always sort of trying to find a way to do things that other people aren't doing, right? So you're sort of finding an extra inch or finding an extra foot, and then the really sort of the in terms of my own experience, the real thing is to just keep going, right? To just to just not quit, right? Just keep moving, keep moving, keep moving, keep moving, and keep going.
Well, on that note, great pleasure to welcome Michael Forgeron of Manadou on Coastal Radio in a tribute interview for Team Canada's women's rowing team, who won a gold medal at the Summer Games in Tokyo. Mike won a gold medal for Canada on the men's rowing team back in 1992, nearly 30 years ago in Barcelona. And as we sign off here, Mike, here's a clip of that national anthem we were talking about earlier, playing for your team after winning that historic event. And you guys couldn't look any happier there. Of course, it's radio. We can't show that video, but hopefully this will paint the picture a little bit for that incredible moment. And thanks so much for your time, Mike, and enjoy the rest of your summer.
Oh, thank you. No, it's been a pleasure, Bill. I enjoyed the conversation, enjoyed the questions, and the opportunity to sort of share my experience with folks that are listening. That was awesome. Thank you.
One more time, we never get sick of hearing it, for the Canadian men's eights, O Canada.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.